Hi everyone, I'm Chris Saldana, and this is the National Education Policy Center's Education Interview of the Month. This month, we're interviewing Morgan Craven, Ellen Reddy, and Kamisha Smith about the use of corporal punishment in K-12 schools. Morgan Craven is the National Director of Policy, Advocacy, and Community Engagement for the Intercultural Development Research Association. Ms. Ellen Reddy is the Executive Director of the Nollie Jenkins Family Center, and Kamisha Smith is the Youth Programs Coordinator at the Nollie Jenkins Family Center. Thank you all for being on this month's podcast. So, Ms. Ellen, let me start with you. What is corporal punishment?
As a matter of fact, I am not going to paraphrase it. I'm going straight to Mississippi Code, which is section 37.1157 for the definition. It says, for the purpose of this subsection, corporal punishment means the reasonable use of physical force, a physical contact by a teacher, assistant teacher, principal, assistant principal, as may be necessary to maintain discipline, to enforce a school rule, for self-protection, or for the protection of other students from disruptive students. This law basically supports immunity for school personnel around the enforcement of rules, as long as, and this I will paraphrase, as long as the assistant teacher or school personnel administer the corporal punishment consistent with the rules and guidelines, the district, the local school board, will provide for their legal fees and protection. Now, if a parent ends up in court and it is determined that the school may have violated their own policy, then the school district can be liable. But that's what corporal punishment looks like and feels like in Mississippi.
And what sort of student experiences have you heard about?
I guess I'll start when we first started the corporal punishment work, which was really kind of 2000. Even to have those conversations inside of community meetings and school board meetings was very hostile. The community was not receptive at all. There were times that I even felt threatened by being in that kind of environment where people were really pushing back because they wanted corporal punishment. In my experience working with students over the years, I have witnessed students with bruises on their buttocks, bruises to their hands, how, you know, when they reach to protect themselves. Corporal punishment, while we oftentimes think it is strictly a hit on the buttocks, it may be a hit on the back, because you can imagine as a young person, I'm not going to stand still and allow you to hit me. So we can see bruises and hematomas, you know, that's bruised blood. And so it can range along a very long continuum.
There also is a lot of emotional abuse, emotional trauma that comes along with it. And one of our youth leaders, Kershevia, shared her story of getting beat. And it wasn't just a beating, it was the teacher beating her and also at the same time talking to her, telling her that you're not going to be anything. So very violent towards the student. And it happened years ago. But when Kershevia shared her story, she began to get emotional and cry through her presentation. So it's those kinds of incidents that we've heard from students and have also documented. Students get paddled for being late for class. Students get paddled for laughing in class. The reasons that students get paddled is not specific to just maybe a student was violent in class or got into a fight. These issues range from whatever they deem you need to be beat or paddled for.
So let me turn to a little bit of the history of corporal punishment. So where did it come from? Was it a punishment that was used broadly across all schools, or was this a practice that was particularly focused in schools with students of color?
Well, I think that we all know that historically whipping children in homes, in communities, inside of schools has a long history. What we see now is really, I think, Europeans coming to the Americas and bringing that kind of toxicity with them. And then we go through a period of enslavement. where we have Africans coming to America. And clearly we all know about, you know, the period of enslavement and lynching. And so we have a history, I think, that flows from all of that. And then when you throw in white supremacy, you throw in Christianity, all of those things kind of get meshed together. So there is a long history of racial terror inside of our communities, whether that's a brown community, indigenous community, or black community. There's even research that looks at the relationship between corporal punishment and history of lynching, particularly in those southern or southeastern states. We all know that there are still 19 states that allow corporal punishment. But when you really look at those 19 states, anywhere from 12 to 13 of those states are either in the south or southeast, where you had this history of racial terror on the lives of brown and black and indigenous communities. So we see that continue to get played out in our lives now.
And I would also note here that one of the definitions of corporal punishment is reasonable force in order to maintain control. So it's clear where that notion comes from. It's from slavery. It was a tool to be violent so that you could maintain control. One of the biggest issues when we talk about corporal punishment and ending corporal punishment is how we are in communities with our own children, because a part of that from slavery, how we interact, how we deal with conflict and resolve conflict within our own homes and communities. A lot of us have internalized that too, in a lot of our communities, seeing violence displayed against children with the whoopings. We've heard stories about, well, lived and heard stories about going to get your own switch, being beat with an extension cord, whatever mama could find. So corporal punishment ending it in schools is the easy part, but a big part of our push too is this bigger conversation of violence and how do we end it, and how do we begin to talk about how we are with children so we aren't creating the same narrative, or the we're trying to end this cycle of violence, and corporal punishment is just one of those topics inside of it.
Can I pick up right there and 100% agree with everything that was said and add, it is like a history of the act itself, but also how we think about children and how we think about forming and supporting children. And I think corporal punishment is just one example of many types of punitive and exclusionary discipline practices in schools that does not take any sort of emotionally supportive, certainly not a science-based approach to child development, but instead takes this very harsh killer behavior right now. In some cases, behaviors that aren't even bad behaviors, they're simply age-appropriate. They're a sign of appropriate growth, of a sign of curiosity, a sign of children just being children. But you know, for a long time in this country and many others, we have taken this very violent punitive approach to children that's just simply not consistent with what we know about their brains or development or what it takes to actually support them and, you know, everything that they need to be.
So let me ask you about that, because I think certainly I was, and I'm sure most listeners are familiar with research connecting a lot of the disciplinary practices that you just talked about, police, suspensions, expulsions, to student academic outcomes. I was shocked when I found out that corporal punishment was still allowed in so many states in the United States. So has there been as much of a, or is there research connecting corporal punishment specifically to student outcomes?
There's definitely research that exists that shows that corporal punishment is harmful in so many ways. Harmful in terms of academic success and making sure children are able to succeed in class and graduate and go on to do the things that they want to do. Forming connections to schools, which are incredibly important for students to feel like they can engage and trust the adults that they're with. Like Kamisha mentioned, like the social and emotional aspects of all of this. We know that corporal punishment is harmful for students in that way. It's harmful to the kids that are watching their peers being hit or slapped or spanked in schools. And so it really destabilizes school climates and makes them really negative for all students, and can actually, there's a study that shows that it actually impacts the academic success of every child in a school that relies on corporal punishment. So I think that the research is clear about the harms. There is no research, no reliable research to my knowledge, that shows that corporal punishment does anything good for children. And I think that when we talk about research, and I'm going to pass it off right now, because what this research does is just confirm what students and parents and families and the folks that Ellen and Kamisha work with have been saying for many, many years in their own advocacy in their communities about the harms of corporal punishment. So this is simply research in the sense that it is published, but the research that, you know, so many young people and families for generations have been experiencing, you know, confirms that this is not a practice that is in any way helpful for children.
Absolutely. I think most importantly, it really disengages young people from the learning environment. You can imagine as a child sitting in class, and while I may not be administered corporal punishment inside the classroom, everyone knows why I've gone to the office. So there is a stigma that's also attached to that child that that child cannot really get rid of. I can remember talking to an elder in the community when we started this work. And one of the things she said was, I would go to the school and beat my own child. And I thought, oh my goodness, you know, chills ran through me to think that we would allow a parent to come to the school to administer corporal punishment to a child. That to me is immoral. I mean, you know, as educators, you know, I've gone to school. I don't want someone to put a stick in my hand and say, this is how you discipline children. You know, we can flip that when we talk about wanting supportive learning environments for children. When we talk about mental health counselors and psychologists and social workers inside of school buildings, they also benefit and support teachers inside of that space. It's not like just the children are the ones that we're asking for this kind of supportive environment. We're asking for this kind of environment for all children.
So let me ask you a little bit about your work, Miss Ellen, with the Nolly Jenkins Family Center. So first, let me ask you, who was Nolly Jenkins and what's the mission of the center?
Well, Nolly Jenkins was my grandmother. She was a little geeky woman who's about this tall. She's a tiny little woman. I grew up in an extended community where my uncles and people who lived in that community cherished children. We had roles, we had tasks to do. You know, I came up during the Great Migration to the North. And so for elders who were left in the communities when their children wrote them, you know, it was a joy for us to go and read those letters because we felt so much a part of the community. So Nolly was our grandmother. And although Nolly was a disciplinarian now, let me be clear about that because I'm from rural Georgia. She was a disciplinarian, but I also had a grandfather who would always ask my grandmother. He would say, Luetta, why are you beating them children? And that was always his word. So to me, that's still the question, the answer we're looking for. Why are we beating our children? But Nolly was our grandmother who played with us, who loved us, and really kind of said to the broader community, this is how we will be with our children. Our children have a purpose and they're valued. And this is how we will grow them up inside of communities. And so I came to Mississippi from Baltimore, Maryland, I think in 94. And we really started as a child care center. We were providing services for teen parents and we had an after school program. Then maybe a few years after that, we had a parent who was having some challenges at one of the schools. Her child was being mistreated. And she came to us and asked us if we would do something about it. And so then we started to use this model of community organizing where we built the power of parents and young people. As a matter of fact, it was the first time we brought young people to the discussion and asked them what was going on. So it was really a new model to open it up. As a matter of fact, Kamisha, my youth coordinator, was in the child care center. So we do this intergenerational work. I am now deep four generations into her family. So, you know, when you're doing intergenerational work, you have the grandmother, the mother, the children, everybody. So when I go inside communities, I am also representing those families, and those families know me because of this intergenerational work that we've been doing over the years.
So I'm sure the Family Center is involved with a lot of projects. But Kamisha, let me ask you a little bit about your work. Tell me what work you do with the Family Center.
So I work with everything involving the youth program. I came up through the work, started as a youth leader, youth coordinator, to now running all of our youth programs. So what that looks like is recruiting students in middle and high school and taking them through a youth leadership and development pipeline. So we started this youth leadership and development pipeline to really give students the tools and skills that they needed to, one, advocate for themselves, making sure that they got what they needed inside of schools, whether it was, you know, better cafeteria food, no uniforms, ending corporal punishment, just making sure that they had what they needed to be their own voices inside of decision-making processes.
So I'm going to switch gears a little bit. And Ms. Ellen, I'm going to ask you about you use the term the legacy of the lash in your work. So what does that mean?
What does that mean for me? In doing this research, and I really, this is a passion for me, whether it is community violence, corporal punishment, just working with young people, kind of serving up my purpose. So maybe a few months back, I ran into a book called Legacy of the Lash, Corporal Punishment in the Atlantic World and Beyond. And I ran into characters in this book. This is the revolt, the 1910 revolt of the Chapata. These were African Brazilian sailors who decided that, you know, slavery was over. They were citizens, but they were still being treated as slaves. They then took 5 ships and, you know, staged a revolt in Rio de Janeiro. And so that touched me, that 1910, here were these sailors who were saying, we are citizens of this country. We deserve to be treated with dignity and respect. And somehow the legacy of the lash, just, it was meaningful for me because we're still there. We're still a part of the legacy of the lash. When I think about what happened to these sailors, while their revolt was successful, you and I both ultimately know that they lost their lives as a result of that revolt. So I wanted to lift them up. I wanted to bring their spirits into this work. Talking about this legacy of the lash is really for us as communities of color to really determine our own narrative around how we will be with our children and the importance of our children to us. And so if we can look at and capture the history of how families have been treated. I spoke to an elder in my community about 3 months ago. He's 88 years old, and he shared with me how his mother would draw a circle in the ground and have him and his brother get on their knees, and she would pop this whip behind their heads even before she hit them. He needs to tell his story. Young people need to hear that story. I needed to hear that story. This is a healing. I think the legacy of the lash is really a healing for communities of color to really come and look at where we are, the violence that's been perpetrated in our own lives that we had very little control over. Now we have control over that. We can decide how we will be inside of communities with our children, with our peers, and with each other. I mean, there is all of this violence around us, and, you know, we don't even need to bring up the slap that was heard around the world. You know, again, that's all the violence that's been perpetrated against us. And so we need to look at that. And so my hope is that Legacy of the Lash will help us to really dig deep and look at who we are as a people. And as we move forward, how do we want to move inside of our communities with our children? So I hope I answered your question, Chris.
In a great way. That's a great segue. That's a great segue to our next question. So tell me a little bit about some of the efforts that are currently underway to abolish corporal punishment.
At the federal level, there is a bill called the Protecting Our Students in Schools Act that has been filed. All of us are advocating more co-sponsors for the bill. We definitely want a lot of support for it. It would prohibit corporal punishment in schools that receive federal funding, so public schools across the country would not be able to use corporal punishment. It would also create a private right of action for families to be able to sue school districts if they use corporal punishment, and it creates a grant program that school districts can apply to for funding to implement some of the research-based positive strategies that I know Kamisha will go into in a little bit. The whole coalition of advocates really want to stress how important the federal legislation is, because we still have the 19 states who have corporal punishment policies on their books, but about 22 or 23 that still report data to the federal government about using corporal punishment. And so it has been over a decade since the last state banned corporal punishment. As Ms. Ellen mentioned, these are, or Kamisha may have mentioned this, these are states that are primarily in the US South. We are stuck in a place where states are not acting in the interest of children. They are not protecting children from clear abuse in their schools. They are sanctioning abuse in their schools, and abuse that disproportionately harms Black students, students with disabilities, and boys. And so we need the federal government, which we believe has a responsibility to act and is required to act, to step in to protect these kids. And we really want that through the Protecting Our Students in Schools Act. And I'll just emphasize that it's one of several bills that, you know, a lot of us are supporting to really take a holistic approach to what discipline looks like in schools and stop a lot of harmful practices that are used against children. Corporal punishment, seclusions and restraints, police, using police against children, and really invest in what we know works. To protect students, make sure every individual student's civil rights are protected, and create the school climates that we want to support all students.
Yeah, at the state level, we have the Mississippi Coalition to End Corporal Punishment, where we've been doing a lot of education at the state capitol with senators, with different stakeholders, and also have created a toolkit for how we move and talk to all stakeholders, including the policymakers, all the way down to the parents and students. We're also doing a docuseries that will uplift the stories and experiences of students who have received corporal punishment, and also this broader issue of violence and the need to end the corporal culture of violence, specifically inside of schools. And to start to have community meetings so that we can start to talk about the alternatives to ending corporal punishment.
So let me ask you about that, Commissioner. I think you make a really good point in that. A lot of this work is educating people of the alternatives, changing their heart, changing their mind. So what are some of the alternatives to corporal punishment?
First, before we even get into the conversation of alternatives, because I think a lot of times we focus on addressing and providing solutions for student behavior with no real effort into addressing the school environments that the students are in. So it first needs to start with safe and responsive schools that make sure that the needs of students are being met, professional development and support for teachers, because the fact of the matter is, unless all parties are involved in these strategies and alternatives that we're trying to implement, if all parties aren't involved, then these alternatives won't even make it to the implementation stage. Along with safe and supportive schools and professional development, we move on to eliminating the role of school resource officers, as well as eliminating zero tolerance policies, making sure that communities are directly involved inside of schools. That creates a school environment where students want to be in. It makes no sense to have these alternatives and school environments are still threatening. School environments are not being intentional, or personnel or districts are not being intentional about making sure that schools are a place where students really feel safe and want to be. So once all that happens, we can move to talking about implementing research and evidence-based disciplinary practices inside of schools, making sure that we equip students with the knowledge and support system it takes to deal with violence or conflict. And I want to back up, because it's not just violence. Students are dealing with stress, emotional trauma, layers and layers of issues that they have no outlet to deal with appropriately or cope with appropriately. And what's ironic about the topic of corporal punishment is that if you go in any detention center across the state, I just speak for Mississippi, you won't see corporal punishment. What you will see is therapists, mental health professionals, counselors, because they somehow put it in their mind that we're going to provide these services on the back end. We're pushing to say it makes absolutely no sense. Those are the services and supports that students need inside of schools on the front end, not when they've come through the pipeline. So it's not a question of, do we need to be violent to students, because it's only permitted inside of public schools, not in other places. So back to the alternative. So we have restorative justice, a model that focuses on developing relationships with students and personnel and staff so that students see how their actions maybe affect the whole school community, and then helping them to engage in making it right. So we have peace circles where students have an opportunity to kind of talk about what's going on. Because a lot of times you see conflict or violence happening or a student changing, it's not just one isolated issue. This student has something going on that we need to address. That doesn't happen. So that student a lot of time ends up in more trouble, feeling like feeling detached from the school, and ultimately ending up going down the road that could have been avoided had we had different alternatives and support services for those students on the front end. We have community service learning, schools partnering with community organizations like ours who have programs like Scholars of Peace that teaches conflict resolution, that teaches students how to be peer mediators, while teaching them how to be strategic learners. So bridging that school to community gap where we can be in partnership with each other, because some of, like SEL, some of these models we've done for years, it's been a part of our work. So if we started to bridge that gap and make the school a real part of community where community is a part and community organizations are welcome into the environment, those are type of alternatives that are there for the schools. But again, it takes intention to say, we're going to do something different, because easy discipline is not always right. And it's going to be hard to change the narrative when we talk about tearing down corporal punishment and putting in the work to make sure that students are able to grow and prosper inside of a holistic school environment. Because at the end of the day, corporal punishment is not an isolated issue. The broader conversation is about violence and how it's continuously used against students of color inside of schools and communities.
So I just have one more question. We're at the point of recommendations. So is there anything that you want listeners to take away from this conversation? If there was one thing that you wanted to highlight, either about corporal punishment or where school policy should go with discipline, or what policymakers should do within the next 6 months, 12 months, what would you want to highlight for listeners?
It's to end, like, sign a bill, end corporal punishment. This plain and simple. That's what I need you to do. And then we can talk about the alternatives and making sure that schools have the resources to implement these alternatives inside of school. So this is definitely one thing to that particular audience that I want them to take away from this.
I have the same takeaway. Like, I am 100% behind all the relationship building and strategies that Kamisha laid out. And we need to do that because that's the right thing to do in schools. And also, it costs nothing and will improve the lives of children to just stop hitting them in schools. And there are plenty of schools in the states that do not allow corporal punishment, where they are getting along without having to beat children in schools. They are not doing things perfectly, and there's a lot of work to do there too. But this is not something to hang on to. There's no good that comes of it. In fact, we know it is harmful. And so just getting rid of it is the most important thing that everyone can do right now at no cost and to the great benefit to children.
Absolutely. And I would agree with both of them. Let's get rid of it at the federal level. Let's get rid of it at the state level. Because for me, if we get rid of it at the federal level, we can also push some other legislation around the Convention of the Rights of Children that would really say to any state, this is how we will treat children. So I really love to see Protecting Our Students in School Act of 2021 pass this session. I would love for our state leaders to eliminate corporal punishment altogether. Use some of the money from Build Better America to implement some of the strategies and alternatives that we've been talking about. This is, I think, at no other time in history that I can think of right now, but we have the resources coming out of Build Better America, American Rescue Act. Those are resources that can be used to do those things that we're talking about right now. Let's do the right thing by children. Let's place children in the center of schools and communities, look at the needs of young people, look at the developmental needs of children. We won't have this opportunity again. And children need this, and children deserve, just like we do as adults, they're citizens. They deserve to be treated with dignity and respect.
So thank you again, Morgan, Miss Allen, and Kamisha, for being on this month's podcast. As always, we hope you're safe and healthy. And remember that for the latest analysis on education policy, you should subscribe to the NEPC newsletter at nepc.colorado.edu and follow NEPC on Twitter at NEPC Tweet.